I thought maybe you were introducing. Hi, good evening. I'm Rachel. Welcome to everyone. Thank you for coming. I don't want to feel like I have my back to you, but I'm going to more angle myself to that way. Is that okay? Thank you. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to pass these out, but I have this funny thing. So here, take one of these. I'm Rachel Berkovitz. I teach here at Pardes. The topic of the status of women within halakha is a topic that is something I feel passionately about, and I think is very important to speak about and learn about. This is a four-time evening lecture series. I hope that you'll be able to come to all four of them. It's a little awkward because there are three different topics that we're talking about split over four. But so we're going to be looking this evening and possibly also next time on women saying Kaddish Yatom. And then we're going to also look about women counting in a minyan. And we're going to look at the aspect of women receiving rabbinic ordination. And on face value, these three things don't have that much directly in common. It's not like one nice little package. Right, it'd be one thing if we had a lecture series that was on women in tefillah, women in kriyat haTorah, and women in minyan. It's a little bit eclectic, but what's interesting, I hope you'll find about all of them, they're all interesting topics in their own right, but they're all unique in a way, in that many times, I don't know who's here and what your background is, but many times when you're learning about women and mitzvot and women participation in ritual, the question that is asked is, well, what's the mitzvah? What's the issue? What's the ritual that's being performed? Who's obligating it? What's your level of obligation? Do men and women have the same obligation? Can women perform things on behalf of men? And that's a basic sort of framework and rubric, which makes sense from the halakha, that is worked through if you're talking about women saying kiddush on Shabbat, or if you're talking, can women blow a shofar, if you're talking about, can women read Megillah? But what's unique about the three topics that we're going to talk about is they don't fall directly into that rubric. The issues that are going to be at play and the topics that we're going to see discussed don't have the sort of technical, what's your level of obligation, who are you going to be performing it for? And so in each topic, we're going to have to see, like, what are the issues at play and how does this play out? So that is something unique about the three things we're going to look at. Before we started, because the course was called Women and the Evolution of Halakha, which we could have like a whole course on just the phrase evolution of halakha, I know, I thought I just would say a few words about it. First of all, this might seem obvious, but I think it's important. The word halakha, which we translate as Jewish law, its root is holech, halach. It's a word of movement, right? It's a word to move, to go, to walk, which I think really reflects the essence of the word. Halakha is not something that is supposed to be stagnant and that should stay still, and that should only be one thing. Halakha is something that moves and walks and is something that is supposed to move throughout a person's life, throughout the generations. And so I personally don't, I assume if you're all here, you as well, but some people get very afraid when they hear the words halakha and evolution or halakha and change. And to me, that is actually the natural outcome of what halakha is. It's taking the set text, or the sources that we have in our history, and applying them to real life and making it be Torat Chaim, a living Torah, and something that works for the people who are living it. Because I had this title, I thought I'd bring a small thing as our introduction before we look at the sources. And this is from, I'm a little biased. It's a book that my grandfather wrote. It's a book called Crisis in Faith. And he has a small chapter on the status of women within Judaism. He wrote many things on women in Judaism, but this I found to be just very powerful and I think really relevant to what we're doing. The book was written in 1976, so it's a little bit, a few of the things that he talks about, thank God, Baruch Hashem, have already changed and developed. Women's Torah learning is something that is, I think, well accepted, at least within the modern Orthodox world. But I think that the way he says things and the power that he says is important, so I just wanted to read, or does someone want to read it? We can have this doesn't have to be a lecture. We can pretend it's a class. Is there anyone who wants to read out loud, who wants to volunteer? Go for it. Here, from just here, and these, read a paragraph, and pause, and then read a paragraph.
In addition to the legal status of the woman, a new concern that agitates many of us today is the religious status of the woman in the daily life of the Jewish community. This is truly a contemporary problem resulting from radically changed intellectual, social, and economic conditions. The concern deals with what should be the place of the contemporary Torah observant woman who adheres to the rules of the halakha in the religious life of the community. Many of these women are well educated at colleges and universities and have a broad and often highly specialized secular education. Is it conceivable that they should continue to be excluded from any serious study of Torah and Talmud?
So, okay, this is the part, thank God, that we're not in, but it's still worth reading. Keep going, yeah.
And of the other disciplines in the study of Judaism as they were in the past. What is bound to be the quality of Jewish life in the homes and the communities if intelligent, mentally alert women, otherwise fully involved in the moral, political, social, and economic issues of the day, should be, as a matter of religious principle, relegated to the status of the ignoramus within the realm where they ought to have their spiritual and religious roots, the realm of Judaism? Is the Jewish woman of today, who intellectually, socially, and often professionally too, is indeed the equal of her husband, to remain only a passive participant in the daily religious life of the community, often only the spectator to Judaism, which apparently is essentially a male concern and responsibility?
Right, so that question, to me, is really at the heart of the issue. Now that times have changed, clearly women's social status has changed, what is going to be women's role within the community? Is she going to be a passive spectator, or is she going to be an active participant? And I think that all the topics that we're going to touch on are going to get to the crux of that issue. If you could continue and read the next paragraph, and then we'll start looking at the sources.
Once again, we have reached a juncture at which the comprehensive ethos of the Torah itself strains against its formulation in specific laws. It is, however, the very essence of the halakha to be responsive to such a strain, and by its resolution to bring about an even richer realization of the Torah itself. Not only is the status of the woman at stake, but the status of Judaism itself. For if, in its application, it could not do full justice to the Jewish woman in her present state, as she is longing for participation in the drama of Jewish realization in accordance with her capacity and spiritual need, its form of such application becomes itself highly questionable. Those who understand the true nature and function of halakha and are committed to halachic Judaism cannot accept such a suggestion. With unreserved openness and sensitivity to the genuineness of the problem, with faith in the vitality of the halakha, with humility and yet with intellectual courage, the necessary halachic work will be accomplished that will define the status of the woman anew, justly and meaningfully.
Okay. So the second paragraph, to me, is also very compelling, that the issue isn't really about how women feel personally, but it's really an issue about Judaism as a whole and halakha as a whole. And if halakha cannot find a way to recognize women's status, then there's actually a very difficult problem for the honor of Torah itself. And so one should be able to ask the questions, look generally at the problems, and look to see where within the text and within our tradition we can find a way to answer the questions. And one thing I truly believe on any topic that you look at is that you have to go back to the original sources and see what they say. Because a lot of times the change actually doesn't have to happen by thinking of a new idea. That the change or the possibility of change or the possibility for other types of behavior exists within the sources themselves. And for whatever particular reason, halakha has chosen to go on one branch of the path of sources. But if we sort of go look back at the core of the roots of the tree, there is a lot more flexibility and possibility. So that's what I hope that we'll do together over the course of these four nights. We're going to look on each of these topics at the sources themselves, see what they have to say, try to understand them, and see where there's a possibility for evolution. Here are some sources. I'm passing them out. Here are some sources. Great. We should have done this before. That was silly. Okay. In the text that we read, he mentioned that women have a desire for more participation in ritual. And I think that's true of some women, but not true of all women. But what I found in my years of teaching and speaking with women, that the issue of Kaddish Yatom, of saying mourner's Kaddish, is an issue that is very close to a lot of women's hearts. And even women who in general, maybe their natural tendency is not to be one who's on the forefront of saying, I need to participate in ritual, I need things to be different. But when it comes to this area where what's at stake is really their feelings about a loved one in their family who they've lost, when it's about feelings for their parents, and when it's at this time when a person is feeling the pain of a loss of a loved one and is looking to Jewish ritual for that comfort and for a way to sort of play out that experience in the way that the community embraces them, it suddenly becomes an issue that there's a desire that women have to say Kaddish. And unfortunately, people don't usually think about it, which makes sense, before they're in the situation. And then it's very hard once you're in the situation and you're in a sort of emotionally low a point to start thinking about, like, what are my rights? What are the sources say? So I think that it's actually really important to learn about this topic and to know about this topic and to be able to advise friends when you see them in this situation. So I would like to look at Kaddish. Kaddish is very, very interesting. We could give like a year-long class on mourner's Kaddish. Mourner's Kaddish is not mentioned anywhere in the Mishnah or the Talmud. Kaddish itself is really not mentioned anywhere in the Mishnah or the Talmud. The one main phrase that we associate with Kaddish of the response that the community says, Yehei Shmei Rabba, is mentioned. First of all, that appears actually in Tanakh. It's mentioned in Tehillim and in Daniel. And it's mentioned in the Gemara as a response at the time when someone is giving a sermon, and it seemed, but in the form of Kaddish as we know it, no mention in the Mishnah and the Talmud, any type of Kaddish. The first place it's mentioned is in a post-Talmudic text, in the time period of the redactors of the Talmud, the Sarvarim, called Masachet Sofrim, and there Kaddish is mentioned, but not mourner's Kaddish. And the main information that we receive, which you probably intrinsically know, but is very important to point out, is that Kaddish needs a minyan. We're not at the sources yet. You required 10 to sanctify God's name. Kaddish is some form of sanctification of God's name, and we need a minyan. I don't know where everyone's coming from or what your background is. Well, I'm going to talk in the traditional language of the halakha that assumes that minyan is male. We're going to do the unit on minyan, so we'll look a little bit more about the possibilities there for this purpose. But I want to point out to you that that's an interesting thing, that when we're going to look at this, we have a group that is defined by males, and we're looking at, can a woman do something that requires that minyan? And the answer, hopefully, give the spoiler, is going to be yes. And so that's already interesting when I talked about how these things are functioning slightly differently than before. There could be things that you need a minyan for that someone possibly, according to some of the traditional halakha, cannot count for the minyan, but could perform the ritual that needs the minyan. Right? For those communities that let women read from the Torah, the same thing. Torah reading needs a minyan. And those communities in the modern Orthodox world that allow women to read from the Torah don't yet count women in a minyan, but they allow them to read from the Torah. So that's one thing that we've already seen is different and interesting. So Kaddish needs a minyan. When it's pretty late to associate Kaddish with mourners. I'm not going to get into, like, scholars try to define what's the reason it arises in this time period. I'm not going to try to answer that question, but I'm going to show you where it first starts happening in Ashkenaz, in France and Germany, around the time period shortly after Rashi is the first time we're going to see a link to to Kaddish and mourners. Right? Some scholars want to say maybe the Crusades, all sorts of things. I don't know what the historical reason is, but this is what we first say. So we're going to look at a number of texts that don't yet have to do with women, because you need to understand something about Kaddish before we even get to women. And so the first text we're going to look at, so everyone has the sheet, you have a nice cover page, flip the cover page, is from Machzor Vitri. This is the Traditions of Rashi, and the students of Rashi compiled it. Now, this is a pretty long text. I'm not sure if we should read all of it. Maybe I'll tell you some of it outside, or you could glance along. It tells a story of Rabbi Akiva. Now, you might know that Rabbi Akiva is a Tana. He's from the time period of the Mishnah. But this story doesn't appear in the Mishnah. It appears in some later Midrashim, and it's brought here. And this story of Rabbi Akiva, it says, Maaseh b'Rabbi Akiva shehaya mehalech b'beit hakvarot. He was walking in a graveyard, in a cemetery, and I'm going to summarize till we read some of the lines out loud because it's very long. And he encounters a man who's naked and covered in coal, and he's schlepping the coal, and he has thorns on his head. He's not in a good situation, right? And Rabbi Akiva assumes that he's alive, which would be your natural assumption if you met a person. And he runs after him, right, shouting and stopping him. And he says, like, who is making you work so hard? Who's treating you like this, right? He thinks that this person is just overworked and being mistreated. And he said, I want to find out who your master is. If you're a slave, I'll redeem you. And the man says to him, okay, don't worry, don't get angry, but actually, I'm not alive. And this is like, and he was a tax collector when he was alive, and he basically was not a great person. And he found favor with the rich and killed the poor. He really was not a Robin Hood. And this is part of his punishment. And right, we won't get into understanding like what this means, how this means, how Rabbi could have met him, Rabbi Akiva met him. And so Rabbi Akiva like basically tries to figure out if there's anything he can do to help him. And if you flip the page, right? And so the man says to him something, but he thinks it's impossible. He says, I'm 1, 2, 3, 4 lines from the top of the page in Hebrew. Ela shamati mehem devar shelo haya yechol liot. I heard something that just can't possibly be. She'im alei haya lo la'ani zeh ben, shu omed b'hakahal, v'omer barchu et Hashem ha'mavarach, v'hem onim acharav, yehei shmei rabba, mavarach, miyad mit yarim oto min ha'paraniot. So he says, if this person had a child, right? And here there's a little bit of confusing. Maybe you already felt it. And the child would get up in the community and would say, Barchu. But then the community will respond, and they don't respond with our normative response for Barchu. They respond by saying, Yehei Shmei Rabba. And like scholars on this text try to understand what's going on here. Maybe this was an original response to Barchu. Maybe Barchu and Kaddish were together. But either way, this is how the story goes. He would suddenly be freed from all his punishment.
Rabbi Akiva, the guy or Rabbi Akiva?
I think it's the guy. Yeah.
The guy heard this.
Yes. Okay. Honestly, I don't know like what we're supposed to imagine how he knows this. And then he goes on to say, but he doesn't really have a son. He left a pregnant wife, and he doesn't know if she gave birth to a son. And here it's specifically talking about a son. So Rabbi Akiva goes that he's going to try to find out. And he goes, and he tracks down the Reif, and it's a whole long process. He finally finds the city, and when he asks about them, the people are so upset. They're like, "Why do you want to find this guy? He's a horrific guy." And they say, "Well, what about his wife?" And they say, "Her memory, she blotted out." Like they're really not. And he asks about the son, and the people say he hasn't been circumcised. He doesn't have brit milah. But anyways, Rabbi Akiva gets hold of this son, and he starts to teach him Torah, and he teaches him Shema, and he teaches him Birkat HaMazon, and now I'm on the top of the third page I've been following, right? It says, V'yamidu lifnei hakal v'omer barchu, and he stood him before the congregation, and he said barchu, so here he's still saying barchu, and they are answering now the appropriate answer. V'heim anu acharav baruch Hashem humvarach. Ubaoto sha'ah. Suddenly, his punishment, he's freed from his punishment. And then Rabbi Akiva has this guy appear to him in a dream, and the guy thanks Rabbi Akiva, etc. And he's been freed because his son has said this. We'll discuss this all in a minute. Let's just read the last line. So that was the crazy, crazy story. And the last line of this text says, V'alken nahagu lavor lifnei hateva. B'motzei Shabbat, Adam she'ein lo avo, aim lo mar bachu o kaddish. Therefore, there was a custom, because of this story, that, now, la'avor lifnei hateva, in traditional rabbinic language, means to be the shlich tzibur, to be the prayer leader. There was a custom that, so we're not yet even talking about Kadishia Toma as we know it, where someone who's not the prayer leader is going to, where the mourner who's not the prayer leader is going to say Kaddish. This is someone who doesn't have parents, who is going to be the prayer leader, and he's going to do it specifically on Meitzei Shabbat, and he's going to say Baruch Hu and Kaddish. Okay, that's what this text said. So, right, Baruch Hu or Kaddish. They seem to both serve the same function. And that, we saw throughout the whole text that there was some confusion between the two of them. So let's just stop for a second and like try to understand what's going on. It seems to be, the understanding of this text is, that a person who is getting punished for their deeds in the afterlife, whatever exactly that means, the only way that he could improve his status is if some extension of himself that is still left in this world does something positive for the name of God, right? So if you're, if his offspring stands in the community and by reciting the Kaddish or saying Baruch Hu causes the community to bless God's name, that is somehow going to affect his status in Shemayim. I do not pretend to understand this in any way, shape, or form. I'm just going to go with it because this is what the texts say. Because normally we don't, it's hard to understand how this works. But this is the premise, okay? That's the premise that this text has. The text clearly talks about a son, and we're going to get to that soon. The custom, and it's important that you see that it's talked about, there's a custom to say Kaddish, right? It says Nahagu, is a custom that seems at first only to be on Motzei Shabbat, on Saturday night. And the reason for this is because the understanding is that even in Gehinnom, even in hell or in where all the punishment is being mediated out, there's still a pause for Shabbat. You still get to rest on Shabbat. And so it's going to be on Motzei Shabbat that whatever punishment your relative is going to be receiving is going to start again. And so that's the key moment when you want to change their status, when you want to do something. Right? There are other minhagim that we have that on Motzei Shabbat, the person who's saying Baruch Hu like draws it out long. So there's a few more moments before the prayer of the weekday begins. But this is the understanding. I know it's hard to talk about something that I keep telling you that I don't fully understand, but I want to look at what the text is saying. So we have only on Motzei Shabbat, it seems to be. It seems to be being the prayer leader, and it seems to be a custom. That's the first text. Shortly thereafter, about a century later, we have the Sefer Or Zeruah. And the Sefer Or Zeruah is a bit more specific about what's going on. He says the following, Min Hagenu Be'eretz Knan. It's our custom in Eretz Knan. That was his nickname for the Czech Republic, Bohemia, where he lived. I don't know. Minhagenu Be'eretz Knan, v'chen minhag b'nei Rhines. It's also the custom. So he is in the Czech Republic. It's also the custom of b'nei Rhines in Germany. L'char shamyu hatzibur ein kelohenu, omeid hayatom v'omer kaddish. So they have a minhag that after the congregation says ein kelohenu, the orphan stands up and says kaddish. And then he says, Uminhagenu mistrava mishum masashaya demased Rabbi Akiva, right? And in our custom seems to be based on this event that happened, the story of Rabbi Akiva. I have three dots. He then goes and tells the whole story again with very slight changes. He actually says that the child got up and said, Yitkadal, Vayomrim Acharav, right? Yeshmei Rabba, that he says Kaddish. He only has Kaddish in the text. And then after he tells the whole story, then is the words that I have in bold. V'chen matza mori harav Eliezer mivarsha detana debe Eliyahu Rabba dekatan homer yitkadal matzil aviv min haparinot. And he says, not only do we have the story, my teacher, Rabbi Eliezer of Worms, the Rokeach, who's from Germany, right? He found in a sefer Tana debe Rabbi Eliyahu that a katan, a minor, and we have to talk about that, that says Yitkadal saves his father from punishment. Are there any extra, were there any extra sources hanging around somewhere? I don't, is there an extra one? Do you have an extra one? Oh, thank you, I really appreciate that. So this is interesting. So we have our story. And from the story, it sounded like the kid was young, right? He had to be circumcised. He's taught Kriyat Shema. I mean, there wasn't an age that was said in the story, but it sounded a little that he was young. And then his teacher says he uses this word katan. I didn't bring the text of Tana de Be'elia Rabba, but in it, it says the child is 5 years old. We're talking really about a young kid who this whole story is talking about. I'm sorry? I can tell it to you. I have it. I can tell it to you after class. I can show you the source effect. Okay. So we have a young child, and it's so far only been a boy, and it only seems to be specifically so far about, it says here, Matzil Aviv. He saves his father from punishment. A number of the texts talk about this idea that there's an understanding that the child is the continuation of the father. And unlike what we do today, that originally Kaddish was only for children to say, sons to say for fathers, because that's the only way sort of it works. Meaning the reverse doesn't actually, if the whole point somehow is my behavior here hasn't been great on earth, after I pass away, it's as if I want my behavior to have changed. So my offspring, which is a reflection of me, does something, and it's as if I did something, and that reflects positively on me. But unfortunately, technically, it shouldn't be that we have the reverse situation of parents having to say Kaddish for children. But if, God forbid, we're in that situation, it's not the exact same thing. Meaning, the parent isn't the outcome of the child. And so in theory, the original halakha didn't think that that would work. Actually speaks very strongly against it. We're going to see in a moment. And I mentioned this just because I want to point something out, is that the Kaddish has evolved and changed a lot over time. It was originally only said for fathers. We know now, quite early on, it gets widened to be for mothers. It was only the child to the parent. Now we have it in all different directions of relatives. We're going to see in a second something very, very important, is that it used to be that only one person said Kaddish. Because if the whole purpose is that I, the child, want to cause the community to bless God, and therefore I want to take the credit for that so my parent can take the credit for that, that only works if I'm the impetus for causing the, right? If five people are saying Kaddish at one time, how do I know that I caused them to bless God's name? And I didn't bring these sources, but Rav Moshe Isserles, in his commentary or his addendums and notes to the Shulchan Aruch, in fact, Rav Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch does not mention Kaddish Yatom at all. In the Sephardi Posek of the Shulchan Aruch, only the Ramah mentions it. And in one of his longest notes that he has, because he basically has to say all the halakha in a note, he has a whole discussion about Kaddish. And he spends a lot of time talking about this very clear hierarchy that there's going to be of how do I figure out who's going to be the one who's going to get to say Kaddish? Because let's say there are three people in a family for one specific family, or let's say there's more than one family, unfortunately, that needs to say Kaddish. Right, and I want everyone to have a turn at saying Kaddish, and there's a whole hierarchy. Am I in the Shiva? Am I in the Shloshim? Is it my Yurt site? Do I belong to this town, or am I just a visitor? And unlike today, where the
adult children, it's talking only about the children,
right?
Not the young.
I'm going to get to that. I promise you, I'm going to talk about adult children. So that's clearly a change we're going to see in 1 second. Well, that is definitely one major change that we see, that there's a switch, that it's adults. In the next text, we're going to address that. But what I wanted to say to you is that that things have changed drastically as time evolves. Yes?
But what they said in both of these is that it's an orphan who will say this. They didn't say, an orphan, in other words, who doesn't have a father. Say, but they didn't say it's during the week after he died, the year, the month, whatever. Does that mean once a child has lost his father, forever and ever, he says Kaddish every day he's in shul?
You're right that it doesn't say, these early texts don't say it. That's one of the things that the Ramah, when he's trying to cover it, tries to delineate how long it is, how it says, how it's figured out. And one thing that is very obvious from the earlier texts, as opposed to today, because I don't know which way it goes, and Baruch Hashem, both of my parents are alive, so I've never had this experience, but I don't know if there's it's one hand a child wants to honor their parent, or one hand there's a feeling of guilt that I need to do something for my parent. There seems to be a very serious feeling and communal pressure, and I don't know which goes first, that you have to say, like, be at shul three times a day, saying all the kaddishes all the time. And in the original situation, you were lucky if you got to say one kaddish a day. They actually, the reason we have mourner's kaddish so many times in the service is because they kept adding them so there'd be more kaddishes to divvy up amongst the people, because people wanted to say kaddish. And if you would say it once, your brother might say it another time, the neighbor who had also lost a parent might say it, and it really had to be split up, and you didn't say it many times. I want to move on to talk about the issue of the kids. So was there another question? There wasn't another question. Flip the page. We haven't even gotten to women yet already. The Maharil asked a question. He says, wait a second. It's clear that there's this custom with kids. It's clear everyone seems to understand that it's minors. How can it be? We know, as I told you, that Kaddish needs a minion. It's a Devar Shebikdusha. And so, can you have someone who's not obligated, right? Minors aren't due a Devar Shebikdusha, right? I pointed out to you, we see it must be true, but he's like trying to work that out, right? He says, so here's the question. Hatama lamin nikra kadish yotom, v'lama hakatanim omrim zeh hakadish ho'il v'hu Devar Shebikdusha. Right? What's the reason that minors say this kaddish? Since it is something that is Devar Shebikdusha, it requires a minion. It's something that sanctifies God's name. And here's the answer. All right, so now we're back to the issue that I said wasn't going to be relevant, but it's relevant for this. It seems to be, and he's going to make this clear later on, that if I was an adult, I would be the prayer leader, like we saw in the original text of Machzor Vitri. Then I would have said Baruch Hu. I would get the community to bless God's name, and I would be through. But a katan, because he's not obligated and therefore can't perform be the representative for the tefillah, can't be the prayer leader, can't say Baruch Hu, so he needs to do something else if, God forbid, his father has passed away. So if he was a gadol, he'd say Baruch Hu, but he can't do this because he's not obligated, so he can't be the prayer leader. And so then he continues, V'kulei kaddish shev de'alma takanta de'rabbanan hinu, aval kaddish zeh lav davar shebechovahu, hilchach yecholim ketanim la'omro. The rest of the kaddishes that are in tefillah, that sort of delineate between the two different sections of tefillah, those are decrees of the rabbis. But this kaddish that we're talking about is not an obligatory kaddish. Therefore, ketanim can say it. And he says, if you look, skip one line, it says, we're after the three deaths. Mishum de kaddish zeh havi tosefet, v'lo chova, this kaddish, this mourner's kaddish, is an addition, and it's not obligatory. V'ho hani gufai lav takanta d'ramnan hinu ela minhag. And all those additional kaddishes are not decrees of the rabbis, they are customs. And he makes a distinction between this type. Yes? You still need a minion for it, but it has a different status within the minion. It's a non-obligatory kaddish. It's a kaddish that is a customary kaddish, okay? Which is very, very interesting. I mean, I think you've noticed whole way through that this word minhag has, right? He says minhag. Every one of the sources I said say it's a minhag, it's a minhag, it's a minhag. So even though the colloquial language now is that people who say kaddish say, I have a chiyuv to say kaddish, and people behave as if they are required to say kaddish, it's very clear from the original sources that it's not an obligation in the way we say there's an obligation to blow shofar, there's an obligation to say kiddush on Shabbat. It is something that started as a custom. Maybe one feels an emotional obligation to one's parents because it can aid them, and out of respect for parents, you might want to do it. But from the technicality, it does not seem to be obligatory on the person. And it seems clear that when the person's saying it, they're not performing a mitzvah on behalf of someone else, right? It's not one of these, I'm doing it and you're fulfilling your mitzvah when I do it. It's, I am saying something positive about God's name in the world, and the community is responding. Yes?
Although, I mean, the way a lot of conventional Orthodox and even non-Orthodox minions function,
yes,
that don't think that women should say Kaddish, somebody else, some male, will say Kaddish for them, Ke'ilu, you know.
For them, meaning along with them or instead of them?
No, instead of them, Ke'ilu, I mean, in a lot of places it's custom to pay somebody to say Kaddish for you, Ke'ilu to discharge their obligation, but since, like, this person's a woman and she can't do it, so a man will do it for her. Or even if it's a man that can't get the shul or whatever, he'll pay somebody else to do it for him, as if it's an obligation that must be discharged.
I 100% admit that the way that people relate to it is of obligatory status.
Right.
So serious, more serious than many other obligations that they take. But what I, from a technical, legal, halachic status, it does not seem to be obligatory. It seems to be a custom that we have. I mean, he said it explicitly,
yeah,
that it's not a chova.
I think that it's interesting.
It's very, very interesting.
People take it so seriously that they will pay someone else to do it for them.
Correct. So much so. I didn't bring you the end of this. Yes, sorry.
I believe that since it is a minhag, over time, minhag becomes dead.
Of course that it becomes, I'm not wanting you to take Kaddish lightly and say it's not serious. And I know it means mean to say that.
It's serious or not. If it's a minhag, over time, it becomes... No.
It becomes a behavior that is very intense.
But it's codified in the Siddur, for example.
Correct.
What I'm trying to explain is,
I want to, because he asked the question about ketanim, I want to ask the question about women, right? And so, it's important for me to, if we're going to ask, like, is it only an obligation on the son and not an obligation on the daughter? That comes from a premise that the whole thing originally started as if there was, you must do something. So even though it has evolved, I'm not trying to tell people to stop saying Kaddish and you don't have to, it's a minhag. I just want to understand, how does the halakha conceptualize this act? So then I can think about it when I want to look at, can women do this? Or how should women play into it? That's why I'm emphasizing this. It's not because I want to tell you should take Kaddish lightly and you shouldn't do it or anything like that. Yes. Correct. You're pointing out lots of problems. But the question is, I think that we don't know for sure what's going on up there. So we are hoping that whatever help we can get, we continue to do it. You're right. There are many, many problems. If we're giving a shiur in Kaddish, I would show you many problems with Kaddish. Meaning there are lots of texts I could bring you that say, for us to try to influence anything after someone's dead doesn't work at all. I know, I mean, that's not how the world has gone, because we really are big fans of Kaddish, as you saw. But I can bring you traditional sources that say this is the most ridiculous thing in the world. It doesn't make any sense. Why are you doing it? Maybe if you taught Torah in their name, some Torah that they had once taught in their life and you continue to teach it, it could affect it. But really, the only way you can affect anyone after their death is if they stole something and then you return that lost object to the owner, maybe that could help them. But so... if we were to look at actually what's going on, there are many texts that say, I don't understand it, how has it developed? And it seemed to be that you didn't actually say it so many times. And we're going to see even in these later, like, the idea that expanded every day and then you did it for a whole year is part of this development. That is very strange. The rest, in another place in this Tshuvot of the Maharil, I didn't bring it for you here, he talks about... He mentions that there are people, adults, who are getting excited about this Kaddish and are trying to do it, and he doesn't understand. He doesn't understand why. It's already, so in the 1300s, he says, Nira lid afilu hagdolim kveda tve akadish di atom yoter mishar kadishot v'barchu mishugim de kadish de have tosef v'lo chava. He says, I don't fully get, like, why adults are getting so excited about it. And he says, v'ein dati meskemet imahem, I don't agree with them, b'zeh. Adarabba, gadol humetuvevo say. It's better to be one who's obligated and do. He thinks it's better as an adult that you should be a prayer leader and you should say baruchu, than for an adult to say kaddish. So already quite early on, this thing that was originally for kids, adults have getting excited about, but the technical people who are looking at the halakha don't fully understand it. And I think that this is because there is this sort of emotional, it's so close to the heart, and there's such an emotional aspect that when people were doing it, they weren't so concerned with the technical halakha. I want to look at some of the earlier sources about women in Kaddish, and then next time we'll look at the modern day, and we'll get to what I thought you were going to talk about, this idea of like men saying along with women, and the question of women's voice. But first, we're going to look at the most famous and the most pivotal tshuva, which is Chavot Yair. I'm in Germany in the 1600s, and he is the first person to talk specifically about women saying Kaddish. So I'm on the bottom of page, I think it is 4, yeah. Source number, what's called 5, oh, it's 5 for you, source number 19. And it says the following, She'ela. First we have to look at the She'ela, because that tells us a lot. Davar zar nasa be'Amsterdam, umufersam sham. A very strange thing was done in Amsterdam, and it became well known there. She'achad na'adar b'li ben. V'tzava lifnei p'tirato, shilamadu asara kol yom, toch yudbet chodesh, bebeito, b'scharam. V'achar halimud tamar habat kadish. V'lo michu b'yadeh chachmei akila uparnasim. Okay, uparnasim. So listen to what happened. A really strange thing. There was one man, he didn't have any sons. Apparently he has a daughter. And before he died, he willed that 10 men should come every day to his house, and he's paying them. He must have been quite wealthy. He pays them. And after the limud, his daughter says Kaddish. And this is the case that happened in Amsterdam, and apparently in Amsterdam, both the leaders of the Kila and the Chachamim of the Kila, the sages of the Kila, didn't stop it, meaning they approved of it. It was okay. They let it happen. So the questioner wants to understand what Chavot Yair in Germany thinks about this case that in Amsterdam. Before we get to his answer, I just want you to pay attention to a number of things about in the question. It's clear that the father understood that if he didn't set up this whole thing, his daughter was not going to say Kaddish for him. That's thing number one. It's also clear that the father believes that that his daughter saying Kaddish will benefit him, right? If the whole purpose is that this is going to help you somehow after your death, right? You wouldn't go through this elaborate thing if you thought there'd be no value to the daughter saying it, right? So on the one hand, he knows this is not going to happen naturally. On the other hand, he goes through an elaborate plan and spends money to make sure it happens because apparently he believes it's going to be of value to him. The other things are, it doesn't happen in the shul, it happens in his home. It's not connected to the prayer Kaddish, it's connected to learning and then saying Kaddish afterwards. here you notice it happens for 12 months, even though now we say Kaddish for 11 months. That's another small thing. We don't know how they got ever to the full year, but already it was a full year once and we've pushed it down to 11 because we don't. If you say it for a full 12, maybe it's claiming your parent is actually a Rasha, is not a good person. And apparently the leaders of the community agreed. They were in trouble by this. I don't know if it's because he's so wealthy, so influential. I don't know why they agreed or what is happening. And I don't know the age of the daughter. She apparently still lives in her father's house. So I'm presuming she's not married. Is she over bat mitzvah, under bat mitzvah? I don't know. But she's not so old. Okay. And now this is what Rav Bachrach answers. As a katan. Well, apparently that is the case. Yes. V'af ki ein ra'aya listor hadavar, ki gam isha mitzuvet al kiddush Hashem. Gam yesh minyan zacharim mikrei b'nei Yisrael, v'af ki ma'aseh Rabbi Akiva, shemimenu makor amirat yatomim kaddish b'ben zachar haya, mikol makom yesh svarag d'gam bat yesh to'elet v'nachat ruach l'nefesh ki zarohi. Okay, he opens up by actually bringing halachic supports for why this should work. He says, I don't have any proof to prohibit it, to prevent it, right? Why? Because of a number of factors. He says, first of all, women are commanded to sanctify God's name, right? In the question of the ultimate sanctification of God's name, whether you should martyr yourself, whether if you are told, I will kill you unless you kill someone else, or whether you worship this idol, women are also commanded to give up their lives. That's the ultimate sanctification of God's name. And women are obligated in that. So, and if Kaddish is an aspect of sanctifying God's name, women are connected to that. And not only that, there is a minyan of Zecharim there that's called Bnei Israel, right? He has in the back of his mind the pasuk that talks about how is it that God sanctified. It says, V'nitashti b'toch Bnei Israel. I, God, am sanctified in the midst of Bnei, children or sons of Israel. So here there's a male minyan. She's connected to the concept of Kiddush Hashem, right? He doesn't talk about an obligation to have to say Kaddish for the parent. He talks about, are they in this category called sanctifying God's name? And then he says something really interesting. He says, I know that story of Rabbi Akiva. That story, which was the source for why we know that orphans say Kaddish, right? By the way, this you see from the Hebrew, Kaddish Yatom means the Kaddish of orphans, specifically meaning you lost your parents. In English, we say mourners Kaddish because the English reflects that expansion to all other family relatives. So he says, I know that original story that was only with sons, but you know what? There's a svara, there's a logical thought process that it should also work with a daughter. Because you know what? She is also his offspring, a descendant. And so it makes sense that her blessing God's name will be profitable and will bring peace of spirit to the nefesh, to the deceased, right? That if the whole purpose is your descendant, someone that is a function of you, are doing something positive, well, she's a descendant of him, right? It doesn't matter that she's female or male. And so his opening to this response seems to give a very strong halachic basis for why this is okay. Nevertheless, don't worry. Immediately in the next paragraph, he says why you shouldn't do it. Mikol makom yesh lachush she'aldei kach yachashu koach haminhagim shel b'nei Yisrael. Nevertheless, you got to worry that by doing this, it will weaken the power of minhagim, right? And minhagim are very powerful, of b'nei Yisrael. Shegam ken torahim, that are also considered to be Torah. V'yeh kol achad boneh bama la'atzmo, al pi svarato. And every person will go out and build an altar for themselves according to their own logic. V'mechse mili de rabbanan ki, I can never pronounce this well, ki kechucha v'atulia. V'yevu legal, So this is a problem in the Girsa. Right here it says it's Gimel Lama Gimel Adin in the I took this from Bar Ilan. If you look in the Ketav Yad, it actually says Lazalzel. It's Zions and not Gimels. And it will like cheapen it or make a mockery of it. Okay, so listen to what he says. He says, you gotta worry that this is gonna weaken the Minhagim that are like Torah. It will be as if you're building your own altar and you're going to make a mockery and a laughing stock of the words of the rabbis. And he says, V'lechen b'ridun zeh yesh, sheyesh asifa v'persum yesh limchot. And specifically in this case where there's already sort of accumulated publicity, people are knowing about it, it's well known, you have to prevent it, right? And he says, that's my humble opinion and that's how I've written. Okay, so we have to try to understand this. Do you want to ask a question? We got to try to understand it. Because there's something very bizarre here. He gave this very good proof for it. And then he says, wait, it's going to be make a mockery of the words of the rabbis. What words of the rabbis he's talking about? He himself said that the story of Rabbi Akiva could be read also, right? The only words that we have are this story of Rabbi Akiva. He said it could be read for a girl. What exactly is he speaking about? And it's not just me that asked this question. A number of people who come afterwards say, I don't understand. What exactly is he talking about? What's he referring to? Is he referring to something about the general status of women that we don't usually, that they sometimes say, you know, the presence of the woman should be more modest and in inside? What is he referring to? He says the statements in these sort of broad ways, and we don't know what he's talking about. Some people want to read him to saying the custom is it's only sons and therefore girls can do it. But it's hard to understand it because we don't have a text that says the custom is only sons. The only text we have is the one he just said could be read for women. What I would like to suggest, this is my personal read of this text, is that if you look at this phrase of Kolachad boneh bamalatzmo. It's a very interesting phrase, right? Everyone is going to go build an altar, like you're worshiping another god. You're having another form of worship according to his own svara. To me, what I think he's worried about, you have to listen here, right? This father did something really fascinating. If he had had a son, the son would have normally said Kaddish, but I just told you something. That son isn't going to get to say Kaddish every day, once a day, for a whole entire year. He's going to get to say Kaddish when maybe he's the, you know, we're divvying it out. Are there other people in the shul who have higher priority? Fine, the week of Shiva, maybe he'll get to say it. But once he gets into Shloshim and then there's someone else who's in Shiva, he might miss out on some of the Kaddishes, right? So this plan of hiring people and doing this in your house is actually a great plan for anyone to do, even if you had sons, right? Because if you think, for whatever reason, the more Kaddishes are going to help you, you want to create a scenario in which your child's going to get to say as many Kaddishes as they possibly can. And so then maybe everyone will start like saying, well, I'm going to have this minion in my house, I'm going to have this minion in my house, I'm going to have this minion in my house, and they'll be all building these bamot for themselves, and that will weaken this concept of that we come together for tefillah, that there's a hierarchy of who could say Kaddish. That is the only possible thing that I can completely understand. Whatever he meant originally is irrelevant in some ways to the development of halakha, but it's important to see that although he makes this very strong statement, I'm not even sure his strong statement is against women. The second thing that's important to notice, which I'm sure you already felt, is that he clearly has these two parts. He gives you the halakhic legal support, and then he says, I don't think you should do it because of what I in modern days would now call like sort of public policy concerns. And because he does that, he leaves an opening for anyone who's going to follow them to connect either of the parts, right? They're clearly going to be people who are going to connect to the parts that say don't do it. But it leaves an opening for people to say, well, logically this makes sense, and maybe I'm going to be able to say yes, and I'm not going to say this is going to make a mockery. Did you want to ask something?
Well, basically, you know, I was wondering whether in fact he was doing exactly that. I mean, his position was the first one, but he was placating the powers that the, after all, it had become a very strong custom for males to do this, and in general, male prerogative.
It's a good question. I don't know what his intention is. He has to be smart enough, meaning to realize that once he sets out the halachic premise and it's out there and clearly he assumes people are going to read his response, that he's putting that possibility into the domain. His language at the end, though, is very strong. It is strong. I don't want to play it down. It's strong language against. Don't do it. Mockery. So I don't know if he was being honest. I don't know what his agenda was. It's hard to know. I do want to say something important, and we're going to read. We'll read one more text, and then we'll read two more texts, and then we'll stop today. And next time, we'll look at the modern sources. The thing I want you to realize, in the case under discussion here, that was allowed in Amsterdam, the daughter's the only one saying Kaddish, right? She's the only one saying Kaddish. She's the only voice being heard. And when he reacted against it, he didn't say, like, the problem is that she's looking like a prayer leader, or the problem is that I hear her voice, or he had some general reaction, but it wasn't to the direct issue. And I want you to see again in this next text, it's very important to notice this, because all the older texts that are talking about women saying Kaddish, it's clear that they might not be saying them in the synagogue, right? This is happening in their own. But when she's doing it at the home, she is the sole voice that this minion is hearing. The next text from a similar time period in Prague is from the Shvut Yaakov. And this is a crazy case. Listen to this case. This is a case, I'll say it outside and then we'll look inside. You have to get this clear. There is a man who passes away. Apparently he passes away at a young age and he has very young children. We're going to see how young in a second. But his father is still alive. So there's the grandfather, the man who passes away, and then the children of the man who passes away, who are the grandchildren of the father. Okay, that's the case. That's the like family dynamic. And listen to what the case is. B'sheleti kan niftar ish achad v'lo haya lo ki'im shtei banot ketanot. Hagdola shebehem hi bat arba shanim. So there's a case where a man passes away, and he only has two little girls, the oldest of which is 4 years old. Bit of crazy. Forget the gender, just the age idea. Okay, and then it says, "B'sha'at chalav tziva alai." The questioner is a rav in a different community writing to this rav. She eten lo hatara shebito hagdola tomar kaddish. Right when he was sort of sick and on his deathbed, he asked, he commanded me to give him permission that his daughter should say, his older daughter, the four-year-old, should say Kaddish. V'lo b'beit ha'knesset klal, but not in shul. We're going to talk about that in a second. Let's read the whole thing. So that was the case. V'ataba aviv shel haniftar, lomar kaddish al b'no b'beit ha'knesset. But now the father, the grandfather of this daughter, is coming to say Kaddish in Beit Knesset. Im shar ha'avilim al vivimo, with the rest of the people who are mourning for their parents. Okay, so the scenario is, the deceased man thought that the person who was going to say Kaddish for him was his daughter, this young girl, and she wasn't going to say it at shul. Apparently she was going to say it at home. But the father of the deceased is now showing up in shul wanting to have like a turn in this hierarchy of can he say Kaddishes with the rest of the things. And the question that the person is asking is, what should I do with the father? Right, if you look at the last line right before it's where it says tshuva, it says v'mikor din demahachi tati yale el da'at sh'aviv yomar kaddish bara mizakeh av avalo lehefech. Right, from the essence of the halacha, would it ever occur to me that the father should say Kaddish? Right, the words in the Gemara that we find this whole concept, not specifically Kaddish, is that the son merits the father, but not the opposite. And so the question that is actually under discussion is, what do I do with the father? Do I allow the father to say Kaddish and Shul, or do I not? And
he assumes
that the daughter is going to say Kaddish. Apparently this person didn't hire anyone to do it. He assumes that his wishes are going to be met, that this daughter is going to be saying Kaddish. And listen to the answer. He starts as he says, "In kein lechora haya nira diyesh la'aviv lo mar kaddish ach v'rach kevan sheitna harama dafka b'makom sheyesh minhag kavua be'ir. B'lav hachi lo yomar kaddish al bano b'makom shar ha'avilim. V'ein lazuz midivrav." Or so he says, right, on face value, I would say, you could let him say it according to those stipulations that I told you that the Ramah laid out in a place where there's a custom to let such a thing happen, that we let fathers do it with the rest of the Avilim. But without any kind of caution of that, then there's going to be a problem with him saying it. And then he says, if you skip a few lines down, it says the word aval. Aval benidon shelefaneinu. That was what I would tell you in general about fathers. Maybe you could do it in certain cases if there was a custom. But in our specific case, shekvar hiniach bat shomeret kaddish bebayit etzel minyan. Ki bebeit hakneset bevadai ein laniach la lomar kaddish klal. And I'm going to talk about that, but let's just get the case here. He said, but in our specific case, where he already left a daughter who's saying kaddish at home with a minyan, although she's not allowed to say Kaddish at all in the synagogue. Bevadai ein laniach la lomar, sorry, I just lost it. Wait, did I read that? Yes. Im ken kfar yesh lo lefayes da'at b'zeh. V'nira d'gam l'inyan ha'tfilah yesh lo aviv lehitpalel rak b'bayit etzel ha'minyan shomer habat kaddish. Aval b'shar tfilo v'kaddishin ein lehem zchut nira li. So he says, in this case, there's a daughter saying Kaddish, and therefore, the son, the deceased son, he's already taken care of. His dot is fine. And therefore, it seems to be that for tefillah, I would recommend that the father would daven at the house with the minyan where the daughter is saying Kaddish. But in the rest of the Kaddishim and Shul, he has no right. Okay, he's not going to say Kaddish there. He's going to daven. Maybe he'll be the shlich tzibur and get to say Baruch Hu in that minyan. But he won't say Kaddish. So, no, he's not. This the daughter saying Kaddish, right? So this tshuva is very, very interesting, right? The questioner and the answer don't have any problem with the daughter saying Kaddish. They accept it as baseline. So much so that they think, well, that makes sense. She's the daughter. She's going to say it. And this father, what the heck does he think he's doing? Because maybe if there was no daughter, no children at all, we would have let the father do something. But there is a daughter, no problem. Okay, he wants to do something, go daven at the minyan where the daughter is, and you could probably be the player leader, and that's it. And so this is very interesting. He completely accepts that there's no problem with the daughter. He doesn't have any problem of it. He doesn't raise any, this is going to cause problems with the minhagim of Am Yisrael. In fact, he's disturbed that the father somehow is going to upset the norms that he knows of how Kaddish works, and not this daughter. And And once again, I'll repeat, right, the girl saying it alone. You could tell me, I know she's a young girl, so maybe they're less worried about her voice. We're gonna address the issue of voice next time. But I want to read one last source. This is a modern-day source looking back at the source of the Shvut Yaakov. This is of Chaim David Halevi, very well-known Sephardi rabbi in Israel. But he just is talking about this psak of the Shvut Yaakov. He says, Rav Shvut Yaakov lo nishal im bat yechola lomar kaddish olav. He wasn't asked if the daughter could say kaddish or not. But katav zeb kedavar pashut biyoter al pi masha hara harav hashoel. And he wrote about it as the most simple thing in the world, according to what the rabbi who was asking the question was teaching about. V'gam harav hashoel harav bepashtut lahatir labat lomar kaddish lelo kol diun hilchati be'etzem avian. And the questioner also permitted the daughter to say kaddish with no halachic debate about the issue itself. V'mashma mizeh shamirat kaddish al yedei habat ayah lehem heter pashut ubarur. Right, and we can learn from this that the saying of kaddish by a daughter was for them just a permissible, simply permissible and clear. And it was apparently the custom in their communities. And he says, therefore, you shouldn't look at the Shvut Yaakov as a lone opinion against those that view, that have the Sfara, that they disagree. Meaning, you might say there's a camp of people that say, no, daughters can't say Kaddish, and then, oh, there's this one Shvut Yaakov, and usually we don't say, if you have a more of a majority versus a one, we say that's a one opinion, you can't decide halacha. He said, don't look at him as an individual, rather look at him as testimony, trustworthy testimony, about the customs of that entire community. Because the questioner and the answer and the father all assume that this to be natural, that this is how this should be viewed. Yes? Right. They're living at somewhat similar time periods. I don't know if he didn't know it. I don't know if he just didn't agree about it. I found some other tshuvot also stemming from Prague that seemed to also take it very clearly. There was customs in the courtyard of the old synagogue of Prague that girls would come and say Kaddish there. Well, we didn't talk about the most important thing, why not in the synagogue, which I have to say something about. But I don't know if it's that he didn't know, or he knew and didn't care, because he lives in Prague, and this is where, meaning in Amsterdam, was also taken as okay. Like, you don't always have to respond to the people that disagree with you if you think your behavior is fine. It's hard to know what people knew or didn't know about. It's clear from this text, both of these texts, that although on the one hand there is communities that are having girls say Kaddish, and there's halachic support for that thought process, that they're not saying it in the synagogue. And that's something that we have to try to understand and look at. Yes, you want to say something?
There's something else, though, that I don't understand. It has to do, you keep saying, you know, even the boys won't get to say Kaddish every day because there's this
hierarchy
yeah. going on. And so the girl, if she's saying it at home, she can't say it. She could say it every day, or Minyan could come to her house every day. But so now, I mean, the Shvut Yaakov is already 1670 to 1733. How long does this go on?
That only one is saying them?
Only one is saying it, and that you have a hierarchy and
sit your own customer.
It's still correct. It's still, it's still yakas, and many yakas shul, it's only one person who says Kaddish. The change that I know about from responsa is an argument that actually happens in Germany and is happening in the in the beginning of the 1800s, where they first suggest, someone first tries to suggest, what happens is that there's a fire and they decide to rebuild the shul. And they decide to build for their community like one large shul, and they're not going to have lots of minyanim. Everyone's going to be in one thing. But once you don't have lots of minyanim, you're really limiting how many kaddishes you can dole out to different people. And they were worried that people were going to start to fight. And so they ask, could we start having people say it in unison? And there's a halachic debate. There are people who oppose it massively, say, you know, we have very strong customs knot, and how can you change it, et cetera, et cetera. But that's later than this.
Okay.
There was a question here, and I want to say something about Shoal, and then I don't know how long you thought you were coming here. So I'll take these questions, and I'm going to say something about in the synagogue, and then next time what I hope to do is to look at the modern sources, and the modern sources are very interesting, because up until now we have had nothing about women's voice or anything like that, and nothing about women in the synagogue, and we're going to have to see that more in the modern sources. But let's take this question, yes.
This is a fairly general question.
Yeah.
Now, I know the customs of the people at that synagogue were actually Baghdadi.
Actually, what?
They were people from Baghdad.
Wait, referring to mourners Kaddish?
Yes, they seem to be.
I don't want to get into the whole thing, but as you saw, the two sources that started to talk about it are from Ashkenaz. As I mentioned to you, Rav Yosef Karo has nothing about Kaddish in his Shulchan Aruch. It's the Ramah who brings it, and it seems to be that this minhag is starting in Ashkenaz, and it slowly spreads to the Sephardi communities, so I don't know exactly when I didn't do a whole research on Kaddish, so I don't know when it reaches where, but some of the opposition to Kaddish and the ideas against it are more in the Sephardi community, in the texts.
Against it altogether? I
have so many sources on this. I wrote a book on this. This is why I could answer you quickly. Hold on. So hold on. I'm going to find it for you afterwards because I don't want to waste your time. What's the question over here? And then I want to say something about synagogues. I don't want to let you go.
The fact that the two cases that we hear about daughters saying Kaddish is that they're young daughters?
Well, so I think the first significant has nothing to do with girls, is that originally Kaddish was for young people. So the question that maybe I think that you're thinking about is, well, Rachel, you said there's no problem. She's saying it alone and aloud. Maybe if she's, you know, not pre-puberty, there's nothing wrong with her voice, etc. So we're going to have to see how that unfolds, because this segues into me, the last thing that I want to say to you is that so both of these texts clearly seem to understand she's not having a place in the synagogue and she's not in the synagogue. So what exactly is going on here? What is the unease, and why does he say clearly she doesn't have a role in the synagogue or a place in the synagogue? So one thing that might come as a surprise to you, or I don't know, yes or no, is that I said you need a minyan for Kaddish. So you need to be, when you have a minyan, the person saying Kaddish has to be in the presence of the minyan. To be in the presence of the minyan means I'm in the same domain as the minyan. Right, that would mean that I'm in that presence of the minyan. Now, the thing is, I don't know if you've ever visited Europe and seen some ancient Bate Knesset or synagogues. The women's section were usually completely separate domains. Either there wasn't really even a women's section, or they're like a wall this thick and maybe a crack, or they're up there, there's a crack. And there are a lot of response on, nothing to do with Kaddish, talking about that these domains are separate domains. I could bring you one. I should have maybe Xeroxed it, and I should have marked it in my thing. But even the Aruch HaShulchan, who is very late, he's at the beginning of the 20th century, he is talking about men. He says, Mihu zeh v'dai ha'omdim be'ezrat ha'nashim, lo yitztarfu im ha'omdim be'beit ha'knesset, af sheyesh chalonot me'ezrat ha'nashim le'beit ha'knesset, v'ru'im elu panehim el pe'elu, kevan she'mechitzot gmurot hem havei shtei rushiyot. He says, it's surely the case that men, he's talking about men, who are standing in the women's section, don't join, yitztarfu means join for the minyan, with those that are standing in the Beit HaKnesset. Even when there are windows in the women's section so that they could see their faces, because this is considered a mechitza gmura, a complete separation, and they are like two different domains. And this is the understanding. I mean, this is this fact that I'm about to tell you is like, has ramifications for lots of things, but meaning the understanding is if the woman is in the women's section, she's not in the presence of the minyan, right? You could say to me, what, for all thousands of years, women weren't part of like tefillah b'tzibur if they answered the Kaddish and Kedusha, right? Yes, that is a problem, and I'm not talking about it right now, but it raises a problem. So the issue is, if you want the woman to be in the presence of the minyan, and you want to do it in shul, she actually has to enter into the men's section. She has to physically be there. And and I hope to show you next time, I'll show you some stories, that is what people are worried about. When he says she can't do it in shul at all, that is the problem. We're going to actually see sources that are going to be okay with that.
Even if she's 4 years old?
Well, possibly yes and possibly no. If you look actually at this next source on 32, which I didn't want to start because I want you to be able to go home, but will be the teaser for next time, he's going to start to distinguish between how old she is and if she can enter into the men's section or not. But what I want you to understand, and we're going to see in the text, that is going to be the key issue. Not so much for the people who are going to say it's okay to say women to say Kaddish, but still say, wait, you have to do a minyan at your home. The issue is not so much per se yet her voice or anything like that. It's her physical presence in the men's section. We're going to see sources that allow that, that have customs of that. And even till there are testimonies of people who testified before World War I that in Europe they remember girls coming into the men's section to say Kaddish. We'll see some of them. But that is the problem within the synagogue, that to be in the presence of a minyan, she had to enter physically into the men's section, and the discomfort seems to be with that. And maybe we're going to make a distinction with age. Maybe we're going to be okay with it. Maybe we're not. But that's something we're going to see talked about in some of the sources. And at a certain point, there was going to be a switch in history where, I mean, all the places that you know that may not know it in many shuls, but if you ever saw a woman say Kaddish, she's saying it in the women's section, right? Unless you go to a minyan that has men and women sitting together. But so we have to look at when's that switch going to happen in the sources, how we're going to see it. So that's the teaser for next week. Yes. So you're already thinking like a halachic thinker, right? That the switch is going to be when people start to claim that mechitzas are built differently, and that we could claim that they aren't complete and utter separations, and that really it's part of the same domain. But the first person who's going to say it is going to get a lot of flack for saying it, and people are going to say, "How can you say such a thing? Ha, da, 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 you know, what are you doing, etc." Yeah. Anyone who needs to go should go. I'm happy to answer a few more questions.
I think it was the custom in Ashkenaz, but I'm not sure. Yeah. I remember reading about that in shuls, you know, whatever, a couple hundred years ago, or maybe not so long ago, there was a custom that there was a woman who was like the shaliach tzibur for the women in the women's section.
We have records of that. We have tombstones of women who are called this prayer leader. We have records of it. And the reason she was there, because you couldn't, it's such a separation, you couldn't hear, you didn't know what was going on, you didn't know anything, so she led. I mean, we have all sorts of things. I think it's the Magen Avraham and Mishabura talk about, like, I don't think women could go to shul to hear Megillas Esther, because there's nowhere they can hear every word from the women's section, and you have to hear every word. So we have lots of testimonies about the fact that the women's section was quite separate. In fact, some of the response call it actually Beit Knesset Lenashim, because it's such a distinctive separate. Yeah.
But that makes a case for a woman to
be in. I see where you're coming from. I'm with you. I'm with you. I'm with you. But I don't know if it makes a case, but it's fascinating that there was definitely a women's space and a women's prayer space, and it was totally accepted in a way that it's not today.
And if there's a woman, who's the shaliach?
Well, the question is, I don't fully know exactly what she was doing, but yeah.
No, but it leans in that direction.
It definitely shows a comfort, or not a, like, oh my gosh, what is this saying, with the idea that we could have solely women's prayer space led by women, right? No one said, like, oh, those women's tefillah groups that they're having in those Beit Knesset Lenashim, you know, what they must be, you know, I don't know what horrible things heretics. You're right. But the question exactly what she did, I mean, she might have read, we have testimony that she did, they read Echa that way. So it's definitely a precedent for something. I don't know if, I think that we could have other halachic texts that might lead towards your idea, and we'll discuss that when we look at Minyan. Yeah. Really, really anyone who wants to go should not feel embarrassed to go, and I'm really happy to keep talking to whoever wants to talk. Yeah.
So you talked about, you know, the discomfort really arising in the issue of the synagogue, about the women coming into the men's space to say Kaddish, but there doesn't seem to be discussion the other way about the discomfort even in the home of a woman praying or saying Kaddish in the like being actually
No, so I, so that's a very good point. It doesn't seem to be that the actual problem is her near men or men seeing her or men hearing her. It's something about the sanctity of the space or how we define these spaces and what's appropriate space. I mean, there's one person I didn't bring you who's the one I told you from Prague that talks about girls saying it in the courtyard of the shul. He's all for girls saying it in the courtyard of the shul, and there's a minion there, etc. But then when he talks about could she come into shul to say it, he calls it as if it's like Lahamid Pesel Ba'azara, that it's like putting an idol in the temple, Beit HaMikdash sanctuary. I mean, it's a very, very harsh phrase, and he just throws it out. He doesn't explain like why exactly, but he's not worried just about girls saying Kaddish. He then goes on to say, I don't understand how fathers bring their little girls to shul. It's a horrible thing. So he's like, he's for women saying Kaddish out of the shul and for no women in the men's section, no matter what they're doing. Like he, and so no matter how old they are. So it's clear that he talks about it as if we would all agree that it's, you know, obviously not the place for him. So he doesn't use phrases like it's going to be immodest or I'll be distracted. He talks about it as if it's like a foreign object to the space, that it's not their space and they don't belong there at all, which is maybe harsh on our ears. On the other hand, the confusion that happens when I was talking about this in my class the other day, just, you know, young girls stay in the men's section, they're in the men's section, they're in the men's section, they're 8 years, 9 years, 10 years, and then suddenly they're told they're not allowed to be there. They don't understand, like, what should actually be the difference? Why can't I be here? So at least, not that I am a fan of his way of speaking, he has, like, a clear idea that this space is for this and this space is for this. But he doesn't completely explain. I don't know if he gets it from the model of the temple, that in the temple, the way that, you know, the what's called the Ezrat Nashim of the temple is not like the Ezrat Nashim in a synagogue. It was a place where both men and women mingled. And then it's called the Ezrat Nashim because at a certain point, women can't go any farther. And then there's the Ezra of the Yisrael, where after that point, a Yisrael man can't go any farther. And then, the whole way the temple was built is like the more and more and more you get to the Holy of Holies, the more limited who can come. Like, even before the Ezrat Nashim, it says foreigners can enter. And then women can go up to a point, then only Yisrael can go up to a point, then Kohanim, and only the Kohen Gadol of the Kodesh Kadoshim and Yom Kippur. So I don't know if he has some image, which, I mean, we'd have to then push it back. Why is the temple that way? Why is there places in the temple where women can be and then places in the temple where women can't be? But it sounds like because he's using imagery of the temple that he's somehow following that model. Just because I talked about the temple, I just have to tell you that when everyone falls on their face on Yom Kippur and says, Baruch Shein Kavod Malchuto Le'olam Va'ed, that's happening in the Ezrat Nashim where both men and women are together without a mechitza. But that's another shir. Yeah.
The source of the discussion, like the 1600s.
Yeah. Yes, that is very good that you asked that. There is one, which is the Knesset Yechezkel. The thing about him, though, is, hold on, I don't know why I can't find anything when I want it quickly. Here it is. The Knesset Yechezkel. He has a pretty long thing. He says the following. He's actually talking about grandchildren. He wants to know if grandchildren, specifically grandsons, if they can say Kaddish. And he says, let me find the line. He actually says, He says, Leben haben, if it's a grandson from a son, V'im harbe avelim yagidu ben haben rak pam echad. If it's a grandson through the son, and there are a lot of mourners who want to say Kaddish, then they should only say, they only get like one. They are allowed to do one Kaddish. Neged bet pamim shomar evel acher versus a different, like a more, like let's say a regular son who'd get twice, right? He's getting one to two out of that. Amnam ben habat, but the son, grandson through a daughter, v'kol sheken labat, and all the more so abat, ein lehem kaddish klal bebeit hakneset. So here he says beit hakneset, so it's hard to know. Neither of them have rights in the shul. Okay, so his main focus is about grandsons. He says grandson through son can get rights, but not the same as son. But grandsons through daughter can't get rights in the shul, and neither can a daughter. And then it says, "V'im rotzim lasot minyan reshut leben habat o lemisha rotzeh lamar kaddish begin hametz ulenikiva klal lo." But if they want to make their own minyan, not in shul, and I can Zerik the source if you want to see it. Then the ben habat, the grandson through a daughter, or anyone else who wants to, meaning it sound, I'll explain to you what it sounds like. He explains earlier, he doesn't actually think that daughters, and therefore sons of daughters, are considered offspring, right? That is his way of thinking. I mean, the whole point is my offspring are going to reflect on me. And so he doesn't think that they are, and therefore that's why the grandson through the daughter doesn't have a right, and that's why the daughter doesn't have a right, and that's why basically you can make a minyan and the grandson from the daughter could say Kaddish, or anyone who wanted to could say Kaddish, because there's no, I'm not looking at the grandson of the daughter as any different than anyone else. But the daughter, no way, Jose. The problem with his response, and the reason actually he doesn't get quoted that much often, is halakhically we don't paskin that way about descendants, meaning in issues of inheritance, etc. We do think that daughters are considered halachic offspring of the person, and we do think that grandsons through daughters are considered the halachic line. I mean, he's trying to prove something based on Yerushalmi about descendants. That's what he talks about first of all. So he is someone that opposes, but and as you know, many grandsons from daughters don't think of themselves as different as grandsons, right? We might have a grandson, right? If the mother couldn't say Kaddish, she might have her son say Kaddish for her, possibly. That's my husband says Kaddish for his mother's mother, because his mother doesn't feel comfortable saying Kaddish. And no one thinks, oi, that's not halachically, doesn't halachically work. So there are people from that time period that outright say that it wouldn't work at all in my understanding of Kaddish. And that's the Knesset Yechezkel. Yeah.
I'm going to have to.
I told everyone they could leave. I'll end.
We have a guard downstairs because since the building is very dark.